And when we talk about the third and fourth noble truth, we talk about the path, the Eightfold Path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, or right collectedness. That's the fourth noble truth. That leads us to the escape from suffering, the escape from dukkha. That is nirodha, dukkha nirodha, the cessation of suffering. So there is the dependent origination that allows us to understand how mind works when there is craving involved. And there is the transcendental dependent origination that allows us to understand the path and the states therein that lead us to the liberation from suffering, that lead us to freedom. So the Four Noble Truths here are actually the blueprint for living a life free of suffering. First, you have to understand what suffering is. Then you have to understand how to abandon that suffering or the causes and conditions for that suffering so that you can experience the cessation of suffering by perfecting the cultivation of the Eightfold Path. And what is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not to obtain what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates affected by clinging are suffering. So when we read the sutta, Sariputta takes apart each of these four noble truths, but he does it in such a way that he first goes into the first noble truth, and then he talks about the most subtlest aspect of the first noble truth. So what are these different levels of suffering? Birth is suffering. Birth is absolutely suffering. When you come out from the womb and into this world, it's a very terrifying process. It's a very confusing process. For many beings, it's not only confusing in birth, but it's also confusing in death. That is why the Buddha says, one who practices the path does not die in confusion, because he or she has understood what suffering is about and has at some point, to some extent, let go of that suffering. So birth is suffering. When we talk about birth, we also talk about the birth of action. A lot of times the kinds of action that we do, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, we have maybe regrets about it, or we may have guilt about it, or we may do something with unintended consequences with the action or the words that leads to some level of suffering. So birth of action, you cannot recall back an action, whether it's a thought, whether it's a word, or whether it's a deed. Aging is suffering. Absolutely, aging is suffering. It leads to all kinds of ailments and disease of the mind or of the body. It causes pain in the body. It causes physical pain in the body. It can cause confusion in the mind. Death is suffering. Death is basically the end of all things for that particular life form, for that particular being. And for many beings, when they die without any kind of guidance. Now, more often than not, in our so-called civilized world, a lot of people die in hospitals. And when they die in hospitals, there's all kinds of sounds, there's all kinds of beeping and monitoring and all of these unfamiliar faces with doctors trying to either revive you or nurses checking up on you. And maybe seldom do you actually see your family. And you see them for a few moments. And what do you see? If you're lucky to be able to have some consciousness, You see their mourning faces. You see them crying. You see them in pain. That dying process is a very difficult process. But if you understand suffering and you let go of the causes and conditions, you can die in peace. And more importantly, you can die in such a way that either rebirth in a higher realm happens or no rebirth at all. So dying is suffering. These kinds of suffering are part of what's known as dukkha dukkha. There are three kinds of dukkha, three kinds or three categories of suffering. There is suffering of suffering, dukkha dukkha. There is viparinama dukkha, which is the suffering of change. And then there is sankhara dukkha. That is a very subtle kind of dukkha. So when we talk about sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, these are all mental states in one way or the other. These also are part of dukkha dukkha. Physical and mental suffering are the suffering of suffering. Not to obtain what one wants and to obtain what one doesn't want. This is part of viparinama dukkha. This is the suffering of change. Things happen seemingly unexpectedly. You miss your flight. You forget somebody's, you forget a meeting. Something happens. Some kind of unexpected occurrence arises, leading to not getting what you want. Or what you do get isn't what you want. So this is the viparinama dukkha. And then he says, in short, the five aggregates affected by clinging are suffering. You see, the aggregates in of themselves, they are just aggregates. There's no self in them. There's no self outside of them. They don't belong to a self, and no self belongs to them. But the nature of most beings is such that they take these aggregates personally. Doing so, there is this inherent suffering, which is the suffering of existence itself. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to find a way out of existence through suicide and ending our lives and things like that. But what that does mean is that we realize that taking things personally in the way of the five aggregates leads to suffering. And how does that happen? Affected by clinging. What is that clinging? Seeing these five aggregates as me, mine, or myself. And what are the five aggregates affected by clinging? They are the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate affected by clinging, the perception aggregate affected by clinging, the formations aggregate affected by clinging, and the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. So he's going to go into the form aggregate, but these are the different aggregates. What are the aggregates? They allow us to experience, whether it's through form, the six sense bases make up the material form, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the brain. That all of that, which is really just unconscious, insentient matter, that's all it is. We take this personally, and that is what causes the suffering. The feeling, which is dependent upon contact with these sense receptors, which are part of form. We take that personally, and that leads to dukkha. The perception rooted in memory and in learning, the perception that this is red, this is blue, that's a tree, this is a dog, this person is wrong, that person is right, based on memory, based on perceptions. Perceptions is a very subtle thing. At the very broad level, it's rooted in memory, but at the very subtle level, it has to do with the idea of a personality, right? When we talk about the perception aggregate affected by clinging, we're really talking about taking things personally, whether it's our bodies, our minds, our careers, our jobs, our relationships, the people in our lives, the image that you have of yourself. That's a kind of perception. The image you have of yourself is dependent upon all of the different experiences that collectively create this so-called self that's there in mind. And then you take that and you use that as a means to judge everything else. And that's also part of perception. Doing this is the process of mana, that is conceit. When we talk about formations, sankharas, formations are those that can be rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion and are related to our intentions. Oftentimes, we take our intentions as personally without realizing that actually all of that is also conditioned by previous actions, conditioned by previous experiences, conditioned by the present situation, whatever is required. And so these are our choices that we make, the intentions that we commit to, or at the deepest level, the sankharas, which allow us to feel and perceive. That's the mental formations, which allow us to verbalize and express. Those are the verbal formations, or that which allows us to move and act and breathe. Those are the bodily formations. We take these personally and cause suffering. And finally, the consciousness aggregate. The consciousness aggregate is that which is aware of the other four aggregates. And so when we come to this sort of awareness or witness or observing kind of consciousness, we take that sense of the observer as self, or self in that observer, or self related to that observer, or different kinds of ways of taking self in relation to that process of observing. So consciousness here is just pure cognition. It's just bare knowledge of what is present. Taking that as self or related to a self makes us take the sense of observing as I am the one who is observing. As soon as I say, I am the one who is observing, now there is me, the observer, and there is the observed. And whenever you have these two, there is the observer and there is the observed. There is the seer and there is the seen and the seeing. There is the hearer and the heard and the process of hearing and so on. If you let go of the self in terms of the seer, the hearer, the one who smells, the one who tastes, the one who touches, the one who thinks, and just allow the process of feeling in terms of these sensory activities and then mental activities to happen without attaching a sense of self, just that, the Buddha says in the Bhaya Sutta, just that is the end of suffering. So now Sariputta goes even deeper and he says, and what is the material form aggregate affected by clinging? It is the four great elements and the material form derived from the four great elements. And what are the four great elements? They are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So whether it was in ancient India or Greece or any other time period, there's always been this idea that matter has been made up of these elements. In today's modern scientific terminology, we could say the earth element is solidity or solid matter. We can say that the water element is liquidity or liquid matter. We can say that the fire element is heat and temperature or plasma, like fire or electricity or the sun. And the air element, we could say, is the gaseous matter. So now Sariputta goes even deeper into what is the earth element. What, friends, is the earth element? The earth element may be either internal or external. What is the internal earth element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. That is head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the internal earth element. In other words, here what Sariputta is saying, whatever is belonging to oneself, of course, he's not saying it belongs to any kind of a self, but he's talking about the body. The body and the internal contents of the body, you know, the skeleton, the bones, the muscles, the sinews, as he all listed. He said, this is the internal element, internal earth element. And whatever is clung to, that is to say, whatever is taken as me, mine, or myself, that is the internal earth element. Now, both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. So what is that earth element? All physical solid matter. Does it make a difference whether it's this body, whether it's this microphone, whether it's this computer screen, whether it's the wall, whether it's the ceiling, whether it's this keyboard, this phone, whatever it might be? All of that, in essence, is the same because it all has the same quality of the earth element, solidity. It is made up of the earth element. So once you see this, then you understand that this body, this brain, that is the physical brain, the skull, the skeletons, everything within this body from head to toe, all of that, which is part of the earth element, is actually dead matter. It's insentient. It's unconscious. Doesn't have any life to it. Okay, so that means that there's no self that can be considered to be an Atman, that can be considered to be a soul that is present in any of these processes. They are just impersonal processes. And that's why Sariputta says here, and that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. What is he talking about? He's talking about attention rooted in reality. Yoniso manasikara. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees thus as it actually is with proper wisdom thus, then you have equanimity. One then becomes disenchanted. That equanimity, seeing things as they actually are, yata bhuta jnana dasanam, leads to nibbida or disenchantment with the earth element, whether it's the body or with anything else. When you understand that, then you don't get upset if your phone breaks. You don't get upset if somebody steals your wallet. It's all just earth element. Doesn't belong to me. This isn't mine. This isn't myself. This I am not. And makes the mind dispassionate. There is vairagya in Sanskrit, viraga, no passion. The mind remains unagitated, unaffected toward the earth element. If there is anything happening in the body, it's just seen as an impersonal process. Now, there comes a time when the water element is disturbed and then the external earth element vanishes. So what he's talking about here is the understanding that even the external earth element is impermanent and subject to destruction. Here he's talking about the water element is disturbed. So here, within the Buddhist cosmology or the understanding of how this whole process works, the understanding is that there are three types of destruction that happen. Cyclical destruction. One type happens in terms of water, in terms of fire, and in terms of air. So here, the water element here is the internal water that's there underneath the earth, or earth's crust. When that gets disturbed, there's all kinds of things that can wreak havoc, and then that earth element vanishes, is dissolute, gone, completely gone. That's the destruction of the earth. When the earth is destroyed, there are no more beings, obviously, because they're dependent upon the earth for their survival. So when even this external earth element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. Pretty self-explanatory there. So then, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass a bhikkhu or anyone who has seen this element as it actually is, that means they have total equanimity of understanding that this painful feeling born of your contact has arisen in me. That is dependent, not independent. Dependent on what? Dependent on contact. Then he sees that contact is impermanent. That feeling is impermanent. That perception is impermanent. That formations are impermanent. And that consciousness is impermanent. And his mind, having made an element its objective support, enters into that new objective support and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution. So let's break down what he said. Somebody abuses you, somebody scolds you, somebody shouts at you, somebody makes fun of you. What is that? That's just mere sound waves, vibrations in the atmosphere that the ear picks up. There is contact. Now, when there is ear contact, dependent upon that, there is feeling. And the interpretation that he or she abused me, he or she shouted at me, he or she made fun of me, is a perception dependent upon that contact. So feeling and perception are dependent upon contact. Formations arise dependent upon contact. And consciousness, the attention given to that, arises dependent upon the formations that arise. So if the formations are rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion, if the formations are rooted in conceit that this is mine, this is mine, this is myself, then it will take everything else, the awareness of it, that is the consciousness or the attention to it, the feeling of it, the contact, the perception, all of that it will take personally. And it will lead to suffering. But if he or she understands that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, then they will be unreactive, non-reactive to any kind of abuse, verbal abuse, because they see that it is just that other person's suffering that is leading them to abuse them, to shout at them, or whatever it might be. But they don't take it. They don't accept that abuse because they see with proper wisdom. And his mind, having made an element its objective support, meaning understood that this support is impermanent, is impersonal, enters into that new objective support, which is freedom from suffering, and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution. There, the mind has deep equanimity. Now, if others attack that bhikkhu in ways that are unwished for, undesired, and disagreeable, by contact with fists, clods, sticks, or knives, he understands thus, this body is of such a nature that contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail it. But this has been seen by the Blessed One in his advice on the simile of the saw. So now it's referring to the simile of the saw. Because even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. That's pretty extreme. But that, I would say, is for monastics. So tireless energy shall be aroused in me. What is that tireless energy? The 6 hours. I will recognize when the mind gets agitated and upset by some kind of physical unpleasant contact. And unremitting mindfulness established. I will be aware. My presence of mind will be there to let go using right effort with that tireless energy. And my body shall be tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified. My mind will remain steady and settled in that equanimity. And now let contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail this body. For this teaching of the Buddhas is being practiced by me. Anytime you 6R, any kind of unwholesome state, you are practicing the Dhamma. When that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha, how does he recollect the Buddha? Having understood the Buddha had said this, the Dhamma, which is the actual practice of the Dhamma, and the Sangha, that there are others who are also supportive of this practice. If equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in him, then he arouses a sense of urgency, samvega. Thus, it is a loss for me. It is no gain for me. It is bad for me. It is no good for me. That when I thus recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in me. Just as when, this is obviously cultural, so take it with a grain of salt. Just as when a daughter-in-law sees her father-in-law, she arouses a sense of urgency to please him, to do something for him, to make him happy. So too, when that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha, having said this, the Dhamma, the teaching, and the Sangha who practices it, if equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in him, he then arouses a sense of urgency. So in other words, if you recognize that you are not listening to the Buddha's words because you realize that you have lost your mindfulness, but if you 6R, recognize that here is this agitation, this frustration, this anger, whatever it might be, because I am taking my body or the sound or the experience personally, and you 6R it, if you see and recognize in 6R, then you have established that mindfulness and you have used right effort by arousing that sense of urgency to abandon that unwholesome state and have that equanimity supported by that wholesome state. But if when, this is what he says, but if when he recollects the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, equanimity supported by the wholesome becomes established in him, then he is satisfied with it. And that at that point, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. Not everything. Much has been done. Why? Because there can still be some kind of conceit in being satisfied with it. So if he lets go of the anger, if he lets go of the craving, he or she lets go of the anger, lets go of the craving, then they experience a pure mind of a anagami. But to become an arahant, you let go of even being satisfied and content and proud in using the 6 hours, proud in following the Dhamma. Now he goes into the water element. What, friends, is the water element? The water element may be either internal or external. What is the internal water element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. So whenever he says clung to, he's talking about taking it personally. That is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, fill of the joints, urine, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. This is called the internal water element. Now, both the internal water element and the external water element are simply water element. So understand that every aspect of your body, whether it's the urine or the blood or whatever it is that is watery, that is of the same nature of the external water element. That is to say that it has no self. It is not conscious. It is insentient. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, have attention rooted in reality. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. The more you get into the habit of seeing things impersonally, the less you will suffer and the more wisdom you will gain. The more you see things as this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, the less karma you produce. And you allow the old karma in terms of that experience, whether it be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, to just continue without any kind of infiltration of a misperceived sense of self related to it. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, develops equanimity, one becomes disenchanted, is tired of it, doesn't want it anymore. Doesn't have aversion, but realizes the impermanent nature and impersonal nature. And so let's go of it. The water element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the water element, remains in a bubble that remains, the mind becomes like a bubble or is in a bubble that remains unaffected. Nothing can penetrate the mind in terms of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral toward the water element. Now, there comes a time when the external water element is disturbed. This is talking about the last time. Here, it could arise instead of an earthquake or the earth shattering, where there can be tsunamis and other kinds of disasters related to water. It carries away villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean sink down 100 leagues. So in other words, the water dries up. 200 leagues, 300 leagues, 400 leagues, 500, 600, 700 leagues. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand 7 palms deep. So in other words, it starts to rise, the oceans rise. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand 7 fathoms deep, even larger than that. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand 0.5 fathom deep, only waist deep, only knee deep, only ankle deep. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean are not enough to wet even the joint of a finger. That's when all the oceans dry up. A lot of different possibilities that could happen that result in the destruction of beings on earth because there's not enough water or there's too much water. When even this external water element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. Same thing. Once you realize that all of these externalities are unconscious and insentient, just like what you seemingly possess in terms of the body, whether it's the solidity or liquid aspects of the body, if you see it as being impermanent and impersonal, then you won't take them to be self. So Sariputta says the same thing. If others abuse you, revile you, scold, and harass you, you should understand it through this perspective, that whoever that they are seemingly abusing and scolding and reviling and harassing is unconscious. It's just this matter. And so once they see this, they develop equanimity. And once they have equanimity, they are non-reactive. But if they are satisfied in that equanimity, he says at that point, too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. What, friends, is the fire element? The fire element may be either internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, or clung to. So again, taking it personally, that is that by which one is warmed, ages, and is consumed, and that by which what is eaten drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested, or whatever else internally belonged to oneself is fiery, and clung to. This is called the internal fire element. So your heat, your metabolism, your digestive, you know, in Ayurveda, for example, in ancient India, they talked about the digestive fire. If there's something wrong with your digestive fire, then everything else, you know, goes for a toss, as they say. So, but that fire is dependent upon, or that heat, or that process of digestion and metabolism is dependent upon internal and external causes and conditions. So anything that's digested, the temperature of the body, when you have a fever, that is the body's internal mechanism to fight off any kind of a invader, external invader, whether that's bacteria, viruses, whatever it might be. So that process, you don't control that. You don't say, you know, I feel sick, so let me have a fever now. You know, you don't say that, you know, let me digest this well. It's all dependent upon various causes and conditions. So by taking them personally and clinging to them, you can cause yourself a whole lot of suffering. You could even think that you're responsible for the fever. You're responsible for all of these things. But if you really see that this fever is nothing but an impersonal mechanism of an impersonal bodily system and processes, then you just let the fever be, unless it's a very high fever. Obviously, you take some kind of medication. Anyway, now both the internal fire element and the external fire element are simply fire element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not me, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, that is equanimity, yata bhuta jnana dasanam. Equanimity or upeka is the quality of seeing things as they actually are. One becomes disenchanted with the fire element, internal or external, and makes the mind dispassionate toward the fire element. Now there comes a time when the external fire element is disturbed. It burns up villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. It goes out due to lack of fuel only when it comes to green grass or to a road or to a rock or to water or to a fair open space. There comes a time when they seek to make a fire even with a cock's feather or a hide paring. When even this external fire element, great as it is, is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So there comes a time when the sun will burn its fuel up. Long before that, the earth will be destroyed. So there's nothing to worry about when it comes to the destruction of the sun. But on the earth, there's all kinds of firestorms, electrical fires, wildfires, volcanoes, all kinds of things that are related to the fire element that can cause destruction. And there can come a point, according to the sutta, where we don't have any more fuel for fire. And so that fire goes out. Likewise, just as that fire is subject to destruction, so too the heat, the metabolism, the digestive processes in the body are impermanent and impersonal. So he says again, so if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass you, who has seen this element as it actually is, that is to say that it is impermanent, leads to suffering, and so therefore should be seen as impersonal, then he lets go of that. He or she lets go of that. But if there is still some level of pride in relation to it, then some work still needs to be done. And what, friends, is the air element? The air element may be either internal or external. What is the internal air element? whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy and clung to, again, taken to be personally. That is upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs, in-breath and out-breath, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is airy, air, airy and clung to. This is called the internal air element. So the different gaseous elements in the body, if you take that personally, that can lead to suffering, because if you have a lot of gas in your digestive system, it can cause pain. Just as it says in other suttas, you know, just as if a knife were carving up one's belly, terrible winds course through one's body, right, through one's stomach. So that pain that arises, you didn't cause it. It has nothing to do with you. It's just a reactive process because there's too much air in the body. So seeing that, you can let go of taking it personally. And when you let go of taking it personally, you only have the one arrow instead of the two arrows. You only have the bodily pain. No longer do you have the mental suffering tied to that bodily pain. And then he says, Sariputta says, now both the internal air element and the external air element are simply air element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the air element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the air element. So seeing this, one becomes dispassionate. One becomes unaffected. And from there, one is liberated, at least temporarily, unless one lets go of all the taints, liberated from any sense of taking things personally. Now there comes a time when the external air element is disturbed. It sweeps away villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. There comes a time in the last month of the hot season when they seek wind by means of a fan or bellows or even the strands of straw in the drip fringe of the thatch that do not stir. So in other words, the air element itself, you know, you have tornadoes and hurricanes and all kinds of strong winds and gusts that can cause some heavy destruction. And there can come a time when it's so hot that not even any kind of wind arises. It can happen. It can happen when you are in a place like India, where in the hot regions of India, and suddenly your air conditioning stops. That can be a lot of suffering. But if you understand that, okay, the air conditioner is off, there is no more lack of the, there's a lack of the air element. But if I take this personally, I'm going to cause myself more suffering. So you let go of taking it personally and just see it as it actually is. Okay, there is no air conditioning. There is no wind. So how do you deal with it? You let go. You seek any kind of agitation and develop deep equanimity. Then he says, when even this external air element, great as it actually is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So then, if others abuse you, scold you, and so on, and one who has seen this element as it actually is, he understands thus that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. So he doesn't take it personally. But through that equanimity and satisfaction in that equanimity, if there is still some conceit, at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu, but there is yet to be more done. Friend, just as when a space is enclosed by timber, and creepers, grass, and clay, it comes to be termed just house. So too, when a space is enclosed by bones and sinews, flesh and skin, it comes to be termed just material form. In other words, just as a house is unconscious, of course, that's arguable now with all kinds of artificial intelligence and smart homes and things like that, but even that is insentient. Even that is a series of impersonal processes dependent upon different causes and conditions. Just as we say that that's a house, or you say that that's a keyboard because it's made up of all the different materials, so too this body is just material form. Now here's something very interesting what he says. If friends, internally, the I is intact, but no external forms come into its range, and there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. This is very interesting. So, what is he talking about? You have the I, you have the form, and then you have I consciousness. What is contact? Contact is made up of three aspects. You have the sense base, you have the object of the sense base, and you have the sense base consciousness. When the I and the form meet, the joining of those two brings up I consciousness, or can bring up I consciousness. These three constitute I contact. But what he says is, when there is no corresponding conscious engagement, when there's no attention given to what is being seen, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. There's no manifestation in terms of there's no actual seeing going on. You could be watching a great movie, and your eyes are just watching the moving pictures on the screen. But if you're not paying attention to what's going on and you're thinking about what am I going to have for dinner, or you think about how that person said this to me, you're no longer having any conscious engagement. There's no more manasikara. There's no more attention. This is why I say attention in nama rupa, the five aspects of nama, the five aspects of mind are contact, feeling, perception, intention, and attention. These constitute the five aggregates. Form with the form aggregate. Contact gives rise to the feeling, so the feeling aggregate, and perception, so the perception aggregate, and intentions through which formations arise, and attention through which consciousness flows. When there is no engagement with anything, then there's no real eye consciousness there. You can literally be seeing through something, not actually seeing anything. And there is no eye consciousness there. That is why for the arahat, when you see them, they have a vacant gaze. They are seeing, but there is no seer, right? Because they're attending all the time to the cessation of that experience in that moment. Likewise with the hearing, likewise with all of the other sensory experiences. On the flip side, if internally the eye is intact, so the eye is working, and external forms comes into its range, but there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. In other words, now in the first case, there was no object that arose and there was no attention given to it. In the second case, there is an object there, but no attention is being given. So the manifestation of that experience doesn't arise. But when internally the eye is intact, the eye is functional, the forms come into its range, and there is corresponding conscious engagement, there's attention, then you are actually seeing something. In other words, take this with the meditation. There is the object of meditation, which is loving kindness. There is the mind, that is the internal. The mind is intact. And the mind has the loving kindness as its object of meditation. If there's conscious engagement, that is to be aware of the experience of loving kindness, then there is a conscious, there's a manifestation of that loving kindness. If the attention has veered off, so there, the mind is intact. Loving kindness might be there, but there's no more attention given there because of a hindrance, then there is no more that manifestation of the experience of loving kindness. Unless you siksar and recognize and bring your attention back to loving kindness. The material form in what has thus come to be is included in the material form affected by a form aggregate affected by clinging. The feeling, what has thus come to be, is included in the feeling aggregate affected by clinging. The perception in what has thus come to be is included in the perception aggregate affected by clinging. The formations in what has thus come to be are included in the formations aggregate affected by clinging. The consciousness in what has thus come to be is included in the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. In other words, everything that has already arisen, that is old karma, is part of these aggregates. He understands thus, this indeed is how there comes to be the inclusion, the gathering and amassing of things into these five aggregates affected by clinging. So he's talking about the old karma. This is how it amasses, dependent upon previous causes and conditions. Now, this has been said by the Blessed One. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. And these five aggregates affected by clinging are dependently arisen. How are they dependently arisen? Well, let's take form. Form arises dependent upon food. Feeling arises dependent upon contact. Perception arises dependent upon contact. Formations arise dependent upon contact. In the scheme of dependent origination, formations also arise dependent upon karma and dependent upon ignorance. Consciousness arises dependent upon formations. Consciousness also arises dependent upon name and form, and vice versa. So these are dependently arisen. That which is dependently arisen is impermanent. That which is impermanent is liable to cause suffering, and that which is suffering should not be seen as me, mine, or myself. Then he says, so these, right? This is the first noble truth. Then he says, the desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding based on these five aggregates affected by clinging is the origin of suffering. The desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding. What is that? Craving, conceit, and clinging. Taking things personally. Craving, that is taking this as me, mine, or myself, that I want more of it, or I identify with it, or I push it away. And in the clinging of saying, no, this is me, this is mine, this is myself. That is the origin of suffering. The removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for these five aggregates affected by clinging is the cessation of suffering. That is the third noble truth. And how do you do that? Through the Eightfold Path. And the six R's, right effort, is the heart of the Eightfold Path. In Majjhima Nikaya 117, the Sutta on the Great 40, there the Buddha talks about how using right effort, one comes from wrong vision to right vision, or wrong view to right view. The wrong factors of the path that leads to destruction and death and suffering. Using right effort, you go from there to the right factors of the path that leads you to the deathless, to Nibbana. So using the six R's, you are utilizing the Eightfold Path that leads you to the cessation of suffering. At that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. Sariputta says the same with the ears, same with the nose, same with the tongue. When you hear something, perhaps you are focused on writing an email and there's all kinds of noise in the air around you. But if you're consciously engaged in the experience of writing the email, the sound might be there because you're not paying attention to it. So the sound will not be taken and seen or rather heard. Likewise with any kind of smell, likewise with any kind of flavor. You could be eating the most delicious meal in the world. It has the right proportions of all of the different kinds of flavor, you know, sweet and spicy and sour and umami and all of that stuff. But if your mind is engaged somewhere else and there's not any conscious attention, there's no mindfulness of how your mind is responding to this experience, that food goes to waste, right? I mean, you're not actually enjoying it. Likewise with the mind, as I said, likewise with the body, whatever it might be. You could be driving, right? And you're actually sitting in your car and you are thinking about this or that, or thinking about what am I going to make for dinner when I get home, or whatever it might be. And all of a sudden you've gone from point A to point B without even feeling any aspect of your body while you're driving the car. There's no conscious engagement. There's no attention. There's no mindfulness, presence of mind to observe how your mind is responding and how it changes from one object to the other. So Sariputta goes through the same thing again. He talks about how the different aggregates affected by clinging, when one sees them as they actually are, one understands suffering. That is to say, the suffering that arises because of taking things personally. When one takes things personally, that is the origin of suffering. When one removes that using the six R's, that is the cessation of suffering. And by using the six R's, that is the fourth noble truth of development of the path. And at that point, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words.